At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
One of this country's biggest enemies can't breathe but loves oxygen. Think about that one. And you've heard of unicorns, an even rarer creature, the decacorn, is flourishing. And what would you pay to keep someone from saying, you suck? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm David Gura, in for Kai Ryssdal. It's Tuesday, the 17th of March, and it's great to have you with us. In just a few months, the value of the website Pinterest has more than doubled. It's now valued at $11 billion. Now, for those of you who haven't used the site or the app, Pinterest lets you pin photos of interest to you onto a virtual board. It's like a scrapbook. The company's been raising money from investors, and Pinterest says that in its most recent round of fundraising, it secured $367 million. We're talking about a lot of money here. So where's all that value coming from? Marketplace's Nova Safo takes a look.
Now, I admit I have an account on Pinterest, but I'm not sure what to do with it. So when I called up avid user Jessica Robinson, I had a very basic question.
What is Pinterest?
Okay, I think it's kind of an idea finder.
Basically, she uses the site like a giant digital scrapbook.
I'm a relatively new homeowner in the past couple of years, so I'm slowly trying to find out what style or what things I would like in my house.
And that's where Pinterest has value, because Robinson is exactly the kind of person advertisers want, says Carol Phillips. She runs a marketing consultancy called Brand Amplitude.
Women still are some of the biggest spenders. They control a lot of the family budget. In categories where they're not the buyer, they're also an influencer.
Categories like groceries, apparel, family entertainment, and yes, home design. On Pinterest, women make up about 70% of the audience. And they're not all early adopters or young teens, says Don Stanley. He teaches digital marketing at the University of Wisconsin.
Pinterest is a mature network.
A network with money. A third of its users are in $100,000-plus households.
It has the deepest penetration in demographics that tend to have a higher socioeconomic statuses.
That might explain the $11 billion valuation, which, by the way, is just a billion less than SpaceX, a company that sends rockets into space. Not bad for a digital scrapbook. I'm Nova Safo for Marketplace.
Watching the value of Pinterest surge got us wondering, how do they come up with values for tech startups? How do you put a dollar amount on companies that often have no revenue and can be the riskiest of investments? Well, that big number estimate is as much art as it is science, or fuzzy math, as Sarah Fryer calls it in her latest piece for Bloomberg Business, all about startup valuation. Hi, Sarah.
Hi.
So just walk us through it. How do you come up with a valuation? Or most commonly, how do you come up with a valuation?
So it's a little bit of back and forth. So the founder will go out and take meetings with venture capitalists, sovereign wealth funds, with institutional investors like the big banks who are trying to get in on these deals. And they'll negotiate. They'll say, you know, I think we're worth this much. This is our projected growth. And the investors will say, okay, I'll give you that, but I want to guarantee that I make my money back no matter what, and I want to guarantee that I'll make it back in a reasonable time frame.
You write about these backroom agreements that happen now with increasing frequency. What gets hammered out behind those closed doors?
the founder of a company will get all of these deals, what are called term sheets, from these investors, and they'll review them. They'll say, oh, well, these guys are promising that I won't lose as much of my stake in the company. I don't have to sell as much of the company's stock in order to get a really great amount of cash to fuel my growth. They'll bounce them off each other. And in the end, what the public hears is just the valuation and how much they raise. You hear Uber's worth $40 billion, Snapchat's worth $15 billion, Pinterest is worth $11 billion. What you don't hear is the steps that it took to get there.
So if this is an educated guess, at what point do investors, do the founders of these companies, find out whether or not that was a good guess?
Probably at the time of the IPO. That's when they really get judged by the public markets. And all of the hype and, you know, coziness of these deals in the private markets get exposed. And so this is, just to give you an example, so Box, for example, the cloud storage company, they went public recently at a valuation that was lower than the valuation that they had promised investors. So they actually had to automatically give their investors more stock at the time of the IPO to make sure that they made everything they wanted to make out of the deal.
$1 billion companies are described as unicorns because of how rare they are. And now we're seeing, as you point out, decacorns, so something even more mythic, perhaps. What is a decacorn, and then why are we seeing so many more of them?
So unicorns were the term for the $1 billion companies, but now there are more than 50 of them. And there are more and more companies that are more than $10 billion in value. And companies are realizing that it's really easy to get capital in private markets. It's easy to go to investors who have fear of missing out on the next Google or Facebook. They want to get in your company early. And they have these multi-billion dollar funds they need to disperse among companies. So they're willing to put in tons of capital. It's all coming together to produce these decacorns.
I wanted to talk about Snapchat. This is a company that's valued at $15 billion. And that puts it on par with Clorox. It puts it on par with Campbell's Soup. These are companies that make actual products. And I wonder, is it advantageous not to have to worry about production? Or does that make it actually harder to justify your worth?
It's one of these growth games. Companies like Facebook and Twitter have taught us that you don't necessarily need to already be making money in order to be a valuable company. You can decide on your revenue path, your business path later. And so these companies that have these what are called hockey stick growth curves, where you see them bringing in users all around the world and people have really high amount of time they spend on the app, then they're thinking, well, all you got to do is turn the switch on and that company will be making tons of money. It's not that easy, of course, but...
Yes, exactly. Sarah Friar wrote the piece, The Fuzzy Insane Math That's Creating So Many Billion-Dollar Tech Companies, for Bloomberg, where she's a reporter. Sarah, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
And as the Fed deliberates over whether to raise interest rates, markets ended the day mixed. Details when we do the numbers. Around 2009, 2010, even into 2011, we heard a lot about underwater homeowners or homeowners with negative equity. To jog your memory, when a house is underwater, the balance of the loan is higher than the value of the house. So if the homeowner were to sell, he'd owe the bank money, often tens or hundreds of thousands of dollars. At the height of the crisis, one out of every four homeowners nationwide was underwater, something that was unprecedented. But things have been getting better, slowly, as Mitchell Hartman reports.
The real estate data firm CoreLogic finds that by the end of last year, just over 10% of homeowners were underwater, owing more on their mortgage than the house is worth. Way better than just after the recession, but still far worse than the historic norm, says senior economist Frank Notaft.
We've still got millions of homeowners, about 5 million, who are still underwater and continuing to be current on their mortgages, make the monthly payments.
True, if they can afford those monthly payments, they may no longer be facing foreclosure or bankruptcy, but they can't sell and move somewhere else to find a better job or a nice retirement.
I think of it as freezing people in place.
That's Ken Johnson, senior demographer at the University of New Hampshire. He says with more jobs being created in more places and many homeowners no longer underwater, people are moving again.
One of the places where we are seeing growth pick up a little bit is in those amenity and retirement areas, lots of golf courses and things like that.
So places like Florida are gaining population again as people move to retire or find better jobs. Also, employers are starting to compete more for employees. John Canale at LPL Financial says they might be ready to take a house off your hands, even if it's underwater or hard to sell.
Companies today might be a little more willing to maybe help someone who's relocating to maybe buy their home in Miami and help them relocate in Dallas, where 4 or 5 years ago they were not.
Of course, as home prices continue to rise in hot markets like New York and California, we could see people taking too much equity out of their homes again and then being caught underwater. But economists say after the housing crisis, homeowners and indeed banks are much more cautious than they used to be. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Coming up, it's sad and depressing and awkward, and we're sort of ashamed of it.
Trust me, it's the last thing you think we're talking about. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped 128 points, 0.7%, finishing at 17,849. The NASDAQ gained 7 points, 0.1%, to close at 4937. And the S&P 500 slipped 7 points, 0.3%, ending at 2074. A reminder that the Dow gets the headlines, but the S&P is the market. Apple got a very temporary 1% bump on the news it would join the Dow average. Today, news that American Airlines is joining the S&P 500, and American shares were up nearly 7%. Index funds track the S&P, not the Dow, and now a lot of them have to buy American. European markets were mixed. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.05%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, a House Homeland Security Subcommittee discusses unmanned aerial systems. That would be drones. FedEx, Guess, and General Mills are slated to report quarterly earnings. And it's National Ag Day. AgDay.org lists some fun facts. Did you know a pig can run a 7-minute mile? I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm David Gura in for Kai Rizdal. Websites used to all end with just a handful of what are called generic top-level domains. Those are the letters after the dot in a website's address. The big ones, of course, are .com, .net, and .org. .edu is in there as well. Well, the organization that governs Internet domains, the Internet Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers, or ICANN for short, has been overseeing the slow rollout of some new domain extensions over the last few years. You may remember .xxx causing a stir. The latest is .sucks, which could cause some serious headaches for companies that want to protect their brands. Tim Fitzsimmons has more.
Vox Populi is the company that won the confidential auction to administer .sucks. They say they have benevolent aspirations for the new domain extension, hoping it will serve as a place for consumers to hold companies accountable online. Here's a promo video.
There comes a time when people get tired of being pushed. We can take it no longer.
Yep, that's Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. But an exemption is raising eyebrows. Any company with a verified trademark, say Comcast, could pay $2,500 to early register Comcast.sucks instead of $10 for a consumer to do so later in the year. John Berard, CEO of Vox Populi, says they aren't trying to ransom large companies into squatting and protecting their brands online.
15 years ago, when Ralph Nader's organizations petitioned the ICANN to create a .sucks, they sought a domain where the companies named would not be eligible to own these names.
But that exemption didn't happen, so the race is on for corporations to get in early and snap up all the .sucks that could be used against them. Jonah Berger, a professor of marketing at Penn's Wharton School, says brand protection is invaluable to large corporations. Open Twitter chats don't always go according to plan.
Consumers say, well, hold on, you know, you're not engaging in good business practices, and companies get upset and they close these things down.
It may be good business to get into the brand protection side of domain registration. The lawyers for former New York Mayor Mike Bloomberg, for instance, spent over $10,000 to gain control of 400.nyc domains, such as bloombergistooshort.nyc and bloombergistoorich.nyc. In Washington, I'm Tim Fitzsimmons for Marketplace.
We'll be right back. Marketplace Weekend has been working on a series with the BBC World Service called Six Routes to Riches. They've gone to Nigeria, to Germany, India, and Brazil, all in search of an answer to the question, how do you make it in the global economy? We're pretty proud of the series. So we want to share a story with you on our show from China. Marketplace's Rob Schmitz brings us a story about what it takes to become middle class in the second biggest economy in the world.
It's 3 a.m. Most of Shanghai is asleep, but Zhang Wenquan is up buying fish at the city's largest wholesale fish market. The 47-year-old is tall, muscular, and sports a buzz cut. He comes here each night to buy fish that he later sells in a smaller neighborhood market. Like everyone here, he moves swiftly through the twisting alleyways in rubber boots. The corridors are covered in fish guts. He's wearing something else, too, a poker face, for haggling over prices. 2 hours of haggling later, Zhang hauls crates of fish and shrimp to his van for the ride back to his neighborhood.
I'm not working this hard so my daughters end up working as fish sellers like me. They've got to go to good colleges and find good jobs with good salaries.
Zhang and his wife own an apartment in Shanghai, a house in the countryside, a foreign car, and they make around $15,000 a year. That's 3 times more than the average urban family makes in China. Yet Zhang insists his family has yet to reach the middle class. Zhang's wife, Shi Huiqun, sells the fish her husband just bought at this stall in a market in downtown Shanghai. Husband and wife share a 19-hour workday. They only get to see each other in passing. But that's more than they see their 16-year-old daughters.
Our twin daughters grew up here in Shanghai and went to school here. But they've had to return to my home village to finish high school because they don't have Shanghai hukou.
Hukou means household registration. And if you don't have hukou for Shanghai, in other words, if you're not registered to live here, then you're not eligible for social benefits like health insurance, a pension, or even a high school education for your children. 250 million Chinese aren't legally registered in the cities where they live. That's a third of China's urban population, most of them hardworking migrants eager to join China's consumer class. And they're dealing with a strict internal passport system left over from China's communist-style command economy 60 years ago. It's a system that many think is holding China's economy back.
Now they need to legalize these people because they need a new stage of consumption. And the next consumers are these migrants.
James McGregor is author of 1 Billion Customers.
If you look at the studies of the future of the Chinese economy, that group of people, if you can get 10 million of them a year and they can become consumers, you can have 6% growth in China for 20 years.
But China's government has resisted making meaningful changes to the hukou system. Local officials worry their cities will become flooded with poor, uneducated migrants, leading to the growth of slums that are common sights in cities in other developing countries. On Saturdays, Shi Huiqun travels 2 hours north of Shanghai to her ancestral village to check on her twin daughters and see how their studies are going. Zhang Ming studies physics while Zhang Yue reads her English homework out loud.
Our own planet, the Earth, is becoming more and more crowded and polluted because of the rapid increase of
population.
The two are identical. They wear identical jackets, identical hairstyles. It's nearly impossible to tell them apart. But throughout our conversation, their mother recites their differences to me. Zhang Ming is ranked 4th in class. Zhang Yue is 15th. Zhang Ming's eyesight is worse. Zhang Yue is quieter. Zhang Ming is temperamental. Zhang Yue is lazier. The girls nod in unison. I ask what they think of their new school and their new home. Zhang Yue, the quiet one, answers.
I prefer to be in Shanghai. I feel like a foreigner here. I think China should allow children to attend school where they grew up. We consider ourselves Shanghainese, but according to our hukou, we're not.
Despite what their hukou says, the family has come a long way. Down the road is the farm Shi grew up on, a couple acres of crops, pigs, chicken, and sheep. Shi's 66-year-old father manages the farm. He says before China's leaders embraced capitalism, the family often didn't have enough food to eat. He says now life is immeasurably better. but not for everyone. The hukou system has forced parents throughout China to leave their children behind in their villages. More than 60 million children, a population the size of the UK, are known as left-behind children. Zhang and Shir have the luxury of visiting their children, but most left-behind children have parents in another part of China. As a result, many of them drop out of school, all but removing an entire population of Chinese from a chance of making it into the middle class. In Jiangsu Province, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
And you can find more from our series about the changing global economy on our website, marketplace.org. Click on the link that says Six Roots. Rust is a nuisance. It can ruin cars and boats. It can render tools useless. And it can be dangerous. A rusted-out bridge becomes unsafe. Corrosion can cause a pipeline to leak. Rust is also a huge economic problem. In his new book, Rust, The Longest War, Jonathan Waldman says it costs us more than $400 billion a year. That's more than the GDP of Sweden. Hi, Jonathan.
Hi, David.
Jonathan, I want to start with a clip, and this is from a movie that you mentioned in your book.
Some of our nation's most important systems are feeling the full brunt of the enemy's effect, including our transportation, public safety, and military systems. So, what could this enemy possibly be? It's corrosion.
Okay, that's LeVar Burton. I think many listeners will recognize LeVar Burton there. How did he get into a movie about rust?
So the Pentagon's top corrosion guy, who's been in his office for about 10 years, has sort of ceded his role as the top corrosion crusader to LeVar Burton, since he's so into science and he's so well known.
And this is Dan Dunmire.
This is Dan Dunmire, the Undersecretary of Defense for Corrosion Protection. Technically, he's actually the head of the Office of Corrosion Policy and Oversight. And for what it's worth, his boss's boss reports to the president.
And rust is, you write in this book, a huge problem for the military. This is something that costs the Pentagon many millions of dollars.
Many billions of dollars.
There you go.
$20 billion a year. They've studied it almost to death. They know that corrosion causes Navy airplanes to be out of commission for, on average, a month a year. And they even calculated the cost per pound that corrosion inflicts on all the different airplanes they have. I mean, it's crazy that they know that.
Why is this something that we don't talk about or hear a lot about? This is not a sexy thing. I remember when the president was trying to get more attention on problems with infrastructure in the U.S., and he spoke in front of any number of bridges, but he didn't bring up rust, he didn't bring up corrosion. It's just not something that we tend to talk about.
It's true. I looked up, there's a database of all the State of the Union addresses, and if you look up the word rust, you'll find mention of the word thrust and trust, but you won't find the word rust. The president has called our infrastructure deficient, damaged. I think he's even said crumbling, but he's never said the word rust. And I think we think of rust, we associate it somewhere between cholesterol and hemorrhoids. It's sad and depressing and awkward, and we're sort of ashamed of it. And I would love to hear someone other than just the corrosion czar say rust.
How do we fight this thing? It's a whole new craft. What's the best way to keep it from happening, to keep it at bay, or even to just reverse it?
The Pentagon thinks of paint as their first line of defense. There's a whole mess of paints. Paints you can apply underwater, paints that are high temperature, low temperature, non-skid, stealthy, sticky, you name it. I think like an engineer, and I thought going into this that there'd be a technical solution to our national corrosion woes. And I think it's actually a cultural issue more than a technical issue. We've had the technology, but I think the solution going forward is one of addressing maintenance and thinking about the long-term livelihood of what we build, and not necessarily, oh, here's some new fancy alloy that nobody can afford and that is hard to manufacture in the first place.
You went to Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. This was a place known for its steel for so long, and you accompany a woman, a photographer, who takes pictures of these old steel mills now in various states of dilapidation. She takes pictures of rust, and indeed the cover of your book is quite beautiful. What does rust tell us about the state of the economy, or what do we associate with rust, do you think?
It's funny, only in Bethlehem did they associate rust with money, because while the steel plant was operating, rust dust would settle all over town on people's windshields, and the steel workers swear they could tell by how thick that layer was, how big their paychecks would be. But the steelworks shut down in 95, and now, I guess in sort of an homage to the steelworks, people call it shuttered and decayed and dying and sad, and, you know, there's pigeons all over the place, and it's just not, it's not inspiring, but this woman sees rust as so magical, kind of this earthly force that does unexpected things, and she captures vivid colors, and she says, wow, look at nature go.
Jonathan Waldman is the author of Rust, The Longest War. Jonathan, thanks.
Thanks, David.
You can read an excerpt from Rust, The Longest War on our website, marketplace.org. This final note, last month, The Washington Post published a piece about a Republican congressman, Aaron Schock, who's 33, had outfitted his Capitol Hill office with a gold-colored wall sconce, a crystal chandelier, and, quote, massive arrangements of pheasant feathers. All that was inspired by one of the congressman's favorite shows, Downton Abbey. Well, the article raised some questions, namely about how he paid for that redecoration, and Schock ultimately spent $40,000 to repay the government. Well, this morning, Politico reported Schock billed the federal government in his campaign for logging roughly 170,000 miles on his personal car. But when he sold that car, it had roughly 80,000 miles on the odometer. This afternoon, Congressman Schock resigned, and so he'll have to give up something that was so important to Lord Grantham, his title.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
And that's Marketplace for Tuesday, March 17th. Today, the Dow dropped 128 points, 0.7%. The Nasdaq gained 7 points, 0.1%. And the S&P 500 slipped 7 points, 0.3%. Caitlin Esch, Millie Jefferson, and Vanessa Smith are producers on our Marketplace desks. Our digital producers are Raghu Manavalan and Tony Wagner. I'm David Gura. We'll be back here tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.